It's the Mike Tech Show, show number 444. This show is a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. If it's tech, it's here. Please visit techpodcast.com. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the podcast. I'm your host, Mike Smith. Thank you very much for downloading and subscribing to the show. Please remember to visit the main website at miketechshow.com. You can email me suggestions and questions for any show topic. My email address is miketechshow@gmail.com. You can leave me a voicemail message. The phone number is 240-949-2450. And that's Mike Tech Show, all one word on Skype. I have a great voicemail that we're going to get to in a couple minutes. Follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/Mike Tech Show. Facebook, send me a friend request on Facebook, and that's at facebook.com/Mike Tech Show. We also have the wiki at mtswiki.com. There you will find links to all of the previous shows and links to the show notes and to the audio. Have a jam-packed show with lots of email and follow-ups. And before we get to all that, you want a faster internet, right? You want your websites to load quicker, and you want to make sure that if your DNS provider goes down, you have a secondary route to your website. That is where Dyn, D-Y-N.com comes in. With outsourced DNS, you can make sure people can get to your websites at all times. With managed DNS, you can even connect items like your webcams or your DVR to a private channel that you can pull from at any time. For businesses, email delivery is critical. If your business relies on that contact list of yours, then DYN's email solutions can get your message to clients and customers. You can send secure email, bulk email, and set up high-volume mailboxes right on Dyn's delivery services. So, DYN, to get faster internet by using DYN for DNS, visit dyn.com/podcast30. Fill out the form and start shopping right away, and you can save an additional 30% by using the promo code PODCAST30. Make sure to visit dyn.com. The first link for tonight is to the bleepingcomputer.com forums, where they talk about the Combo Fix repair utility that I always recommend when a system is heavily infected. Well, they had an infection within the Combo Fix program. And I think I'm going to be battling this tomorrow with a client that used Combo Fix. Here's how I try to for Combo Fix. You do not use it unless the system is absolutely infected. It's not a go-to first tool unless you know there's an infection. A great example is that FBI blocking you from doing anything. Combo Fix does repair it, but now we got this issue with it being infected. I guess the information's changing all the time, so I don't know when you're going to hear this. So just follow the link in the show notes to the forums that should update you on what's going on with the Combo Fix repair. But I wanted to get that out there. And this was sent to me by Bill. Bill, thank you very much. He actually sent it to me under the Tech Vets email. And I just thought of that right before I was going live. And I was like, boy, I really want to share that with everybody. And then, of course, you know, Carrie and I will definitely mention that on Tech Vets. And hopefully there'll be a show next week. Let's start things off with this great voicemail from Kevin, the computer doctor, who has a follow-up to two things that we've been talking about.
Hi, Hi, Mike. This is Kevin with the Computer Doctor in Richmond. I'm just giving you a call in reference to show 442, halfway through listening to it, and had a couple comments I wanted to put in about. First, you were talking about profiles, user migrations, and, of course, how you use FABS. And while I agree FABS is excellent, it's actually my second favorite tool when it comes to migrating data. My first favorite, believe it or not, is actually Microsoft's Easy Transfer utility. The one that came with Windows 7 is fantastic, and it works well in Windows 8 also. So whether you're migrating to Windows 7, Windows 8, and it, they did have a different version back in the XP and Vista days, but it's fantastic. It works so easy. I can't swear that it will transfer Outlook plugins, but I would assume it probably would. I have not had a chance to ever test that. But, I mean, it grabs everything under the sun. And the, one of the my favorite parts about it that FABS just doesn't do is it can create the new user. So when you have already gone through and backed up all the data using the Easy Transfer utility, you move it over to the new computer, you run the utility. And if you had multiple users in the previous computer and you've only got one single user on this new computer, it will actually have the ability to go ahead and create those new users right here in the utility. So you don't have to create the users first and then restore data. That's absolutely a huge time saver when you have a lot of users. I think it would probably grab everything you would want it to, since it's Microsoft and you're talking about Microsoft Office products that you were having some issues with. Give it a try. It's wonderful. Love it a lot. The second thing, you had a listener write in about Synology, or excuse me, running QuickBooks from a NAS. Here's how it works, and you are right. You absolutely can run QuickBooks with the database stored on a NAS. Now, when it comes to multi-user mode, what you have to do is you have to select an individual PC in that work group or domain environment as basically the host. Even though the database can still reside on the NAS, you still have to basically make one of the computers the master of the actual QuickBooks program. It's real easy to do. It basically prompts you for it when you're setting it up. Now, for the listener, if you are basically migrating the QuickBooks file, the database, over to a NAS, but you still have QuickBooks already installed on all the computers, what you'll probably need to do is go into each individual instance of QuickBooks and drop it back down into single-user mode, and then move the database over, open up one computer, whichever one you're going to want to become your master, open up QuickBooks, and then select over to multi-user mode, and then it'll prompt you, do you want to make this the host computer? And you just say yes, and that's really all there is to it. If you have any troubles, QuickBooks actually has a pretty good little network diagnostic utility you can download off their website. It helps you kind of sort out problems. I actually just came across this exact scenario just this past week. That tool really helps out, and it tells you, you know, if this is the master computer or not, and helps you dedicate one to be a master. As always, I'm listening. Have a great night.
Kevin, thank you so much. Great, great recommendations. The Easy Transfer utility I have not used. And interesting that you mentioned that they made great improvements to Windows 7. My client, I had some really tough times with XP. And that's why I don't know if the older utility does a good job with XP. But thank you so much. And especially for that QuickBooks tip. That's awesome. Let's continue a little bit more with Java. This is a follow-up from Kate. How to use Java when Firefox blocked it? Mike, I know this issue isn't that captivating to many of your listeners, but I heard your rant about Firefox blocking Java and just want to pass this along to you. I have the link to the article that shows how to activate Java for a single instance or always for a given site. Firefox now uses a click-to-play technology that makes that possible or mandatory, depending on your point of view, and that is explained briefly, and we have the link. Whether or not you read this on the podcast, I hope it helps with your many Java-using clients. Actually, I hope you do read it on the podcast. It's nice to hear the American pronunciation of Java once in a while, even if that pronunciation is influenced just a little bit by South Philly. So go Niners, Kate. Thank you. And I'll be rooting for our neighboring state in Maryland, the Baltimore Ravens. Now, this is about the Java exploit from Curtis. And we actually had a customer remove Java from all of their workstations because of all of this. We have a piece of software at my employer's that we install on customer networks with their approval. It runs on Java, and now it is dropping left and right. We also ran into a situation a long time ago when 60 Minutes ran a special where someone grabbed a little info off an old copier hard drive. This is not the case with hard drives on copiers anymore, as most have a built-in data overwrite system. However, we still have to either surrender the hard drive to the customer or give them a certificate stating that it was destroyed. Anyway, take care and thanks for the great show. It's interesting when mainstream media picks up certain technological stories and things, and then when everybody starts reacting to it, we get good and bad. And this is one of those in between. You know, it's great to educate everybody, but bad if it's an overreaction. And I just read today where Apple is going to be blocking Java. So I don't know where this is all going to end up, but I guess it's great to position everybody with the ability to have it off and turn it on as needed. And that's probably the best way to position your client or yourself to stay protected. Turn it on when you absolutely need it for certain sites, certain programs, but have it left as default for everything else just so you don't get accidentally hit. I'll tell you my advice, though. Make sure you're running Malwarebytes Pro. And I have a link, the left-hand side of the website, that you just click on it. Malwarebytes Pro will block lots of bad stuff that can possibly happen to your system. And I think having that is probably more important than anything else. Continuing with Kate here, she recommended a solution that someone needed multiple network settings and to be able to stack multiple IP addresses because they have static IP addresses for visiting different clients and they need different IP addresses and they needed a utility that could handle all those different settings. And I recommended one last week, but Kate followed up with NetSetMan. And I think the full version's $18. I sent that info to Chad and he says, I have to say, I really like NetSetMan. I went ahead and bought the pro version because of the 6 profile limit of the free version. It runs great. And the fact that it supports stacked IP addresses is fantastic. Thanks again. Tell Kate, thanks for the recommendation. That's why this stuff really does work. When you reply with a recommendation to me and I forward it to the person that needed that info and they love it, that's what this is all about here. As we tried to solve everybody's problems in the Mike Tech Show community. Thank you. This is from Jared. Hi, Mike. This is a long story. It's interesting, though, so I don't think you'll get bored. I would love to know what you think is going on with this problem. This is a good from the trenches story. I've been working on this problem for exactly a week. No, not a crazy long time, but still, it's a while, and today I finally fixed the issue. At work, our main application for HR, payroll, general ledger, and employee self-service is called Springbrook. It's a nice, though slightly bloated, application that works for us. It's important to know how Springbrook is used for this story to make sense. Please bear with me while I give you the rundown. The Springbrook application is installed on Server 1 along with the programs OpenEdge and Progress to handle all of the data processing for Springbrook. We have a separate drive just for Springbrook, OpenEdge, and Progress. When the app is executed, the login page is opened in Internet Explorer. Springbrook uses the LDAP protocol, in our case, Active Directory, to authenticate the user trying to log in against the login IDs already inside of Springbrook. So when the session is established, it requires that the user logs in and is authenticated to the domain, which in turn makes the connection to the LDAP connector, which verifies user info and allows them access. How do the users run Springbrook? I have set up a map drive to the server on their workstations. I set up a desktop shortcut to the executable so the employees don't have to go to that map drive each time and double-click the executable. So it looks and feels like Springbrook is installed locally on their workstations. This setup works great for local users, right? What about remote users? We have those. One currently, but we're about to have one more permanent remote user. I decided to go with the VPN option in our SonicWall TZ210. It works great. It was fast, surprisingly, and the user didn't have to go through remote desktop to use Springbrook, which was nice. I mapped a drive to the server, so she was able to use it just like the local users do. Fantastic. Well, 8 days ago, Springbrook ran a service pack for the application. No problem, because they do that on occasion to correct problems in the modules. The next day, my remote user couldn't use Springbrook. I asked her if the VPN connected fine, and she said, yeah. I connect to the network, but I can't log in to the application. I told her to wait, and I would be there in about 15 minutes. I went through the checklist and found that nothing should be preventing her from logging into Springbrook. I was so confused. The only change was the service pack install. I contacted Springbrook about this, and the tech told me somehow the authentication isn't happening in the VPN tunnel. Okay, I knew that. He then said that they use Citrix for their remote employees. I'm sure Citrix has a very nice web app tool, but if I can do this through a VPN tunnel and save us money, that would be great. I don't like to go with paid solutions if we can implement a solution with equipment and software we already have. So, since I couldn't figure the problem out, I decided to hit the forums. A person at Server Vault recommended the VPN option in Windows Server 2008. I thought, why not? I set that up in my lab. The VPN connection was fast, smooth, and near painless. Anyway, I connected to the VPN server, accessed the Springbrook share, ran Springbrook, and guess what? I couldn't log in. The exact same problem. I was livid. Suddenly I thought, why don't I try adding the .local to the domain name in the domain field? The Springbrook login window requires a username, password, and a domain. All users, and I mean all of our users, don't have to put the .local for the domain. However, when you're up against a wall, you'll try anything. I added .local to the domain name, and the Springbrook application launched. That fixed the issue. I couldn't believe it. I then wondered if that was the problem going through SonicWall. I called the remote user, asked her when I could work on this with her, and she said now, and so I went to her office. I enabled the SonicWall VPN connection, ran the Springbrook application, added the .local to the domain name, and like a charm, I was running Springbrook. The user was happy, and yeah, I was happy, but I want to know why I have to add the .local to the domain name when logging in remotely now. Remote users didn't have to do this before last week. Why now? Now, I'm not sure why now, but I'll give you my opinion in a second. I'm not satisfied. Could it be the recent Springbrook Service Pack update? I contacted Springbrook support, and hopefully I'll hear back from them soon. Anyway, lesson is to try the easy things first, like usual. Jared, thank you for the story. And there's a great point to this. I've ran into certain authentications that require the .local, and yet I've ran into some that don't. And it really depends on the application and how they're passing the authentication. What's happening is their application, clearly they made a change that now her credentials weren't looking correct and it couldn't authenticate. And so that's why you had to add the .local. Did you ever notice, depending on your DNS and how it's set up, if you ping a workstation, let's say it's another server and it's called ABC. If you ping ABC, you may not get anything. But if you ping abc.local for the domain, or ABC, let's say it's the domain is 12, well, can't be 12. Let's say the server is called test and the domain is abc.local. You would ping what they call a fully qualified domain name, and that's what's happening. And it's always best to use the fully qualified domain name whenever you're doing any authentication. Even if it doesn't need the full path, it's a great practice to use it, because especially small business server, if you pick the name for your domain and it's called test, it's going to show up as test.local. So it's not going to be .com. It's not going to be .net. And this is so DNS is not confused with a real domain name out there called test. Let's say I want to call my domain Google, okay? And it'd be google.local. And this way, it would not get confused with google.com, which is a completely different domain. So the .local was a great invention by Microsoft when they realized that with Active Directory, you got to separate your local domain from the real domains out in the real world, where it could be .net, .com. I remember some documentation early on from Microsoft where they would recommend .net for internal and .com for to match your external. The problem is .net is used out in the outside world, and there could be lots of confusion. So this is where the .local comes from. Continue to use the fully qualified domain, and it's a great lesson here. When in doubt, when you're having any kind of an issue, and it's anything to do with permissions or logging in, go to the fully qualified domain name. Know what that is and enter that. All right, this is a NAS question from Mike. I know you are a big proponent of using a NAS. Well, in the right situation, I am. I am trying to wrap my head around backups, however. I can understand if the users are saving to their local hard drive. I can use Syncback to back up to the NAS device. I can also see situations where the business has a file server and the file server runs a backup job to the NAS. I actually don't recommend that. Okay, I think that's a big expense. My head cannot, however, wrap an idea around backing up the NAS itself. Most cloud backup services I have found don't do map drives. How does one go about getting the backup from the NAS offsite for disaster recovery in a way where the whole process is automatic and not subject to human error? The best way is to look at the NAS technology itself and the device itself. There is a synchronization built into some NASs where they can sync to another NAS, maybe with just cheaper hard drives. So you could have one NAS set up with all the fault tolerance that you want, RAID 5 and lots of storage, but then have a similar NAS from the same manufacturer, but be RAID 0. Who cares? It's just a backup to the data. Now, to get it off-site, you do need a system that can map to the drives, that can, and there are services that allow that. You got to find the right one, and maybe that's where we need to talk about what to do with that, or sync that to a local system where maybe that system is just sitting there and it's only for backup, and it's a cheap computer with lots of drive space, and you've taken your NAS and you've synced your data to it, and that computer is backed up to the cloud. So it's just one system. NAS is for companies that want centralized storage, and they just want fast access to the storage with minimal overhead, where you don't have to worry about having a real computer and having to maintain a computer with updates and worried about the computer being infected. And if you don't need a server and you don't need server-based applications, that's where NAS makes sense. But you got to back that up. And you're right. And I don't know if I helped you be able to wrap your head around this. I don't recommend NAS all the time. Matter of fact, I have a client that on Monday I'm going out to that I'm setting up a local PC with storage because the NAS will be too complicated for them to manage that for the storage, for what they're doing. And because of encryption, and yes, you can encrypt NAS data, but this particular client, a NAS did not make sense. It made sense to have a PC with shared storage. You have to look at how many computers, how much data are they using, how do they want to back up everything. You can back up to a NAS from all the workstations, but boy, that's expensive. You know, why not just have a cheaper storage to be able to back up? I don't know. I would not build an expensive NAS just for backing up data. That would not be my first choice for selecting NAS. So I don't use NAS for backing up unless it's included with the regular data. An example, Synology, I can have stored central data and it also acts as a Mac time capsule for being able to back up using Time Machine. So those shares, I can also get backup of the Macs to it. That's an added bonus with all that storage. I wouldn't pick it though as the primary source. I don't know. That's just the way I'm looking at it. I don't know if this helped or made things worse. Let me know, Mike. This is from Bradley. One of my clients has Outlook 2003. Every time he wants to send an email and the contact isn't in the address book, he is forced to fill out a contact form. Is there a way to instruct Outlook not to do this? It's been a while since I've used Outlook 2003, and I don't even have one set up. So putting this out there to everybody, I did not realize. I remember using Outlook 2003, and I remember I could send to anybody without filling that in. There's got to be an option in the Outlook settings to not require that. And if anybody can help me with this solution for Bradley, I will get that to him. Thank you. This is from John. General comments. Hi, Mike. I'm a new listener to the podcast. I've started studying computer infrastructure as of last June after previous doing communication and psychology. Your podcast give me real-world knowledge of what I could be looking if I were to find myself in an IT department. I am currently doing a network fundamentals class in college through Cisco Academy online. Subnetting is a beast. I am hoping an IT career will pan out for me. Your podcasts are helping to enlighten me in the area. I have no certifications at the moment, but hope to have A+ before August. This is John in Florida. Hey, John, good luck. And along the way, if you got some questions, and feel free, keep letting me know how you're making out. And if you got any questions where we can help, good luck. This is Brad. Hi, Mike. I'm a longtime listener of your show, and I really enjoy it, and I take a lot away from it. Thanks for keeping geeks like myself entertained and informed every week. I was wondering if you happen to know anyone who wants to start podcasting. I'm the editor of Venture Break, a group written blog focused on tech news, etc. We do mostly written journalism, but we're planning on getting back into podcasting and sticking with it this time. Our past attempts didn't work out due to scheduling conflicts. We're looking for several hosts, at least one producer for very basic audio editing. And there's more information, and I'll put the link up. If you know anyone who may be interested, could you perhaps refer them to me? Thanks in advance. Cheers, Brad. Brad, I absolutely will. And this is the letting everybody know, if you're thinking of doing a podcast or want to get involved, then let me know. I'll pass on your information to Brad. It is a huge commitment to set up, to make sure that you're doing this. I've been doing this for 8 years now, and it is a huge time commitment. It's not just the couple hours I'm in front of the mic on Thursday nights. There's prep time. There's the post-production time and getting the audio right. You know how difficult it is because of Carrie and I for Tech Vets. We can't get together every week. You know, there's weeks where I'm available, and then all of a sudden it's like the 1 week Carrie's not available. He's traveling, and we couldn't get together. This week, for instance, I was not available to be able to record. Having to rely on someone else is very difficult. It's why the Mike Tech Show is just, I'm by myself. I don't have guests. I don't have a co-host. I do not have to rely on anybody else but myself. But I've been doing this so long that I have lots of clients who understand. Thursday nights are kind of off limits unless it's an emergency. My family just supports me 100%. So we know not to schedule things or not to have anything. And if there is sometimes, you know, I have those occasional weeks where I'll reschedule a Thursday night. But you've seen my commitment to this, and it's very, you got to ask yourself, am I willing to do this every week? Don't let it slip. If you are going to get into podcasting or joining someone, don't let it slip where you go a few weeks without a podcast. It's hard to keep a dedicated following if you don't produce on a regular schedule. It's one of the challenges we have with Tech Vets. We want to maintain that high level of energy that Carrie and I have, and we don't want a pod fade, and we're serious about what we want to do, but we also have our own lives and our own consulting that we got to take care of, and that has to come first. It's a serious commitment, and I just wanted to share all that just to make sure that if you're thinking of this, think of what I just said and filter that and then come up with your decision. This is from Kate, and we're going to wrap up with this email. Windows 8 versus Kaspersky Pure Internet Security. Here's something that might save you and listeners some time. I set up a couple of laptops for a customer today. Both were brand new HP laptops still in the box. She bought Kaspersky Pure Internet Security for both of them. I removed the Norton trial version, cleaned everything, installed Kaspersky, and moved along with setting up the computers. I got to the end of the setup and was showing the customer how to navigate Windows 8, including how to close a Metro app. Of course, first, you have to be able to open a Metro app. So I opened Calendar. It opened for less than a second, then vanished. Almost all the other Metro apps, but confusingly not all of them, behave the same way. I could see they were docked on the left side of the screen, but I couldn't keep them open. Long story short, I uninstalled Kaspersky and everything was fine. Couple of takeaways here. I probably should have waited to the end of the session to try to open and close apps. In my defense, I've set up a couple dozen Windows 8 machines, and this is the first time I've seen this happen. Luckily, it was also the first time I'd set up Kaspersky on a Windows 8 machine, and this happened on both machines. So that was a pretty big clue. But still, she bought the antivirus at the same place at the same time she bought the computers. Oh, but they don't have a clue wherever she bought that. As a matter of fact, shame on Kaspersky for not properly working within Windows 8. I should have checked that it was compatible before I installed the product. Yep, should have done that. Luckily, I made her check the simple accounting before we started installing that. It was not compatible, and she had to buy the upgrade. We left it that she would deal with Kaspersky about refunds or upgrades or whatever. I enabled Windows Defender while she sorts that out. I have to go back later in the week when the simply accounting dust settles and get that installed. Thanks, Mike, for all you do. Some great takeaways here. Windows 8. It's a different beast, and not everything's going to work perfectly. Now, you know my recommendation. If you get Windows 8 or you have a client and you don't like the Metro interface, go to Classic Shell, which is free, or Start 8, which is the $4.99, where it suppresses, where you can actually have all kinds of settings, where you can suppress the Metro from starting, and that's the one I like. I have not run into as many Windows 8s as I did when it first came out. There was this uptick of some home users with, you know, I had a couple. But right now, I've been entrenched with business users still buying, and I still recommend Windows 7 Professional as the main operating system. And since right now Dell is continuing to support that and sell that as a primary operating system, I'm right there. I have less to worry about. I say that. I have less to worry about with Windows 7 in the business environment than I do Windows 8. And so I haven't ran into that yet. So right now, my recommendation is research before you have a client that's going to impact their main applications. Make sure that it's going to work under Windows 8. With Kaspersky, I'm not big on adding the antivirus to Windows 8. You got the Windows Defender, which is really Microsoft Security Essentials underneath, and that's fine. It's built in. I'm not going to add another layer of complexity to the system. What I mean, I may add Malwarebytes Pro, Web of Trust, add some other security, you know, sprinkle some different security measures. And I'm just not, I know a lot of people like Kaspersky. I'm not a fan. I'm not a fan of any of those, Norton and McAfee, all of them. I'm just, the only other non-Microsoft antivirus that I recommend is Avast, because I've had good feedback, good performance on other systems. So to me, narrow it down to two, and that's either Microsoft Security Essentials or Avast. And that's the best that I can recommend, especially because Avast is free. So that is it for tonight's show. I want to just remind everybody to just continue to use my Amazon link. I really appreciate it. It's amazon.mikenation.net. I also have the link miketechshow.com/Amazon, and you can get to them on the website miketechshow.com, miknation.net. Both URLs take you to the same place. And when you shop at Amazon, your price is the same, but a commission comes back to me and it helps support the show. I want to thank Dyn, DYN.com, for sponsoring the show. I really appreciate it. That's it. I will talk to you next week. Same time, same channel. Bye-bye, everybody.
You've been listening to The Mike Tech Show, a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. Please visit techpodcast.com.